Now, on this InvestTalk podcast, Justin Klein listens to your questions and provides unbiased answers. InvestTalk, over 31 million downloads and counting.
I wanted to get your opinion on ticker symbol.
I just really like it as a long-term play.
Appreciate the show. Appreciate all the knowledge. Thanks, guys.
Your participation makes it unique. 888-99-CHART.
This podcast is produced by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. KPP Financial. Independent thinking, shared success. And now today's podcast.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, November 1st, 2021 edition of Invest Talk. Yep, it is November. I hope everyone had a great holiday. Great Halloween. Hopefully, maybe you have some kids, had some good trick-or-treating. I know we had some fun around here, and but that also means that we pivot now towards the holiday season. And no matter what time of year it is, rain or shine, day or night, you need to be making steps, taking steps to make good financial decisions. And whether that's saving, whether that's investing, whether that's spending it properly, all of those factors go into you achieving your own version of financial freedom. So I'm here to help you, hopefully, with all of it. I know we talk a lot about investing, and investing is certainly the most interesting part, probably, of those three factors. But we want you to have good money habits in general. And so I'm going to do my best on this podcast to operate with a mission statement, which is independent thinking and shared success. And that's our assurance to you. No matter what I'm speaking about, I'm here to give you the facts as I see them and present it all without bias using my 20 plus years of investment experience. So I'm Justin Klein. And of course, I encourage you to contact me with your finance and investment questions. And when you do that, you get to shape this show to however you want it to look. I can talk about whatever is on my mind, but ultimately, you are the one that matters. So you can call right now during our live stream program, 4 to 5 Pacific time, or leave a question on our Anytime Voice Bank at 888-99-CHART. So let's get right to our first listener question now.
Hi, my name is Mike. I had a question about ticker symbol CEI, Camber Energy. I have a small position in it, and I was just wondering if it's a good time to you holding it, or perhaps I downsized it in my portfolio. I appreciate the show. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Looking at Camber Energy, and this is a small company, $304 million market cap. They are engaged in the exploration and production of oil and natural gas properties in Texas. Problem is they're not producing anything. They've had $100,000 in revenue for the past four quarters, losing money. So they're exploring and not getting much out of it. I don't know why you would invest in a company that just can't seem to find oil. I don't understand the problem here. Yeah, I don't know what. Yeah, I like the space. It's an oil and gas E&P. And those that can actually drill, they don't have an ESG mandate, they're going to earn outsized profits in this environment, because they don't have the big competitors that have a lot of money typically to go out there and drill, baby drill, like they would in a normal upcycle for oil and gas. And the smaller players are the ones that should be able to do that, like this. But they're not able to do it, because, or at least they're not being successful at it. So it had a big spike up. Now it's back down. It went from, I don't know, it's about 40 cents a share in August to $4.50 a share in mid-September. And now we're down to $1.22 to close today. I don't know why you'd want to mess around with this. Go invest in a real company that produces real products, that has real revenue. This is a company that just eats up shareholder capital. So, and they've been doing that for a decade. Their operating cash flow for the last decade's been negative. So I don't know what this company's doing, but it's certainly not successful. And I don't know why you'd ever touch anything like this. Sell it. Now, my focus point today is based on the story behind this headline. In one of the most volatile markets in decades, active fund managers underperformed. We're going to look at that. Also, we're going to touch on the onshoring or the farewell of offshoring and outsourcing, and where CEOs are now shifting to onshoring and some trends there. Also, central banks are now looking to pivot to tighter monetary policy, not just here in the U.S. Remember, the Fed meeting starts tomorrow. There'll be an announcement on Wednesday in regards to tapering of QE. And it's not just here in the U.S., but Canada, U.K., et cetera. We are getting tighter monetary policy and what that could mean for interest rates and markets. And then lastly, Exxon is thinking about abandoning some of its biggest oil and gas projects. Another shot across the bow of oil and gas and more crimping of new supply. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. Oh, actually, let's look at the market today. Let's touch on the market. You had kind of a mixed market. The S&P was up 8 points modestly, but you had the NASDAQ that was up 97 points and the Russell. That was the big mover today. The small caps were up 60 points, almost 3% on the Russell, which was a change of scenery. They were the laggards to break out, and it looks like we're getting a bit of a breakout pre-Fed meeting. Now, what does that mean? Well, it probably means some more bullishness till the end of the year, but that's what I'm seeing right now. We are continuing to get new earnings announcements, and they are tending to beat, and the beats are getting rewarded more than the misses are being punished. So that's kind of what's happening in the market today. You had gold up. You had interest rates, the 10-year. That was up about 2 basis points to 1.575 going into, once again, a very important and crucial Fed meeting for markets. There you listen to Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. With all the changes we see happening, it's important to keep your eye on the ball. The task of building your own version of financial freedom must continue each and every day, and we are here to help you not backslide in that endeavor. Now, we should talk about whatever is on your mind, so give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
The stock market is volatile. It's constantly changing. So how are you positioned? Is your portfolio properly balanced, or are you taking unnecessary risks? You can get guidance anytime for free if you go to investtalk.com and take the brief Riskalyze quiz.
Hi, I have a question regarding employee stock options in 401k. I work for the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC, ticker RY. In our 401k, they give us an employee stock option where it looks like we get to buy stock at a discount. And it looks like when we buy that, is the dividends just get reinvested into the stock. I started buying into this in my 401k at the beginning of the stay-at-home orders, and it has grown into a significant part of my 401k. So my allocation is I only invest 1% of my check every time, but it has grown into about a 12% of my 401k. My question is, what are your thoughts of the Royal Bank of Canada for long term, and is this too much of my allocation? Should I be taking part of that and reinvesting it into something else? Thank you.
Well, 12% of your overall retirement assets in one stock, it's a bit high, but I don't think 12% really raises a ton of red flags for me. It's not 20+%. I think 20 is definitely too high. 10 to 15 is kind of my range that you want to be in. You're kind of in the middle of that. So that's fine. And Royal Bank of Canada, obviously a very large bank. And, the biggest worry is there's some frothiness in the Canadian housing market, but you could say that about a lot of regions. But it's also a sector that is highly regulated and governments want to keep them together. Now, does that mean that Royal Bank of Canada will be a great investment long term? you know, it's okay. Return on equity is pretty high, about 18% trailing 12 months. That's pretty good. And historically, it does have a mid to high teens return on equity, which is very good. But like most banks, you work for one. They're pretty leveraged, and that can bring some volatility like you saw in 08. So what I would do is just make sure it doesn't get too much higher than where it is now. Like you said, you're adding to it. You're investing more. You're getting that discount. You're getting dividends, et cetera. Just make sure it doesn't balloon too much. You know, so many people back in we had people in Qualcomm days, the heydays of the first tech bubble, they were multimillionaires because they had so much Qualcomm stock, and then Qualcomm had a big crash with the rest of tech, and that created a lot of millionaires that turned into 100,000-aires. And that changed the dynamic of their retirement situation. So just make sure 15% is probably where I would cap it. And Royal Bank of Canada, or like I said, overall, not a bad place. Definitely worse places to be in the financial sector. Now, my focus point today is based on the story behind this headline. In one of the most volatile markets in decades, active fund managers underperform. Now, well, that's the headline, but it is some pretty interesting data here. And it's Morningstar looking at 3,000 active funds. And it basically said about 47% of them outperformed. And so a little bit more than half underperformed in the trailing 12 months. So call it during the pandemic and early parts of 2021, which you would think would be a good time for active managers, but it was about average. Now, I think those numbers are kind of what you should expect. Over a one-year period, it's always hard to really tell. Plus, active funds are always going to have higher fees. So if you take them all in aggregate and you take out a higher fee level compared to the index, you're going to have the majority underperform. And this was a very slight majority underperforming. So I don't really take a whole lot of stock in this, but it is an interesting stat to see what the pandemic did versus active versus the passive debate. This definitely wasn't a shot across either way in my book. Now, 25% of all active funds beat their passive counterparts over the last decade, but that's skewed because only 11% of large cap funds outperform. So you start digging into bond funds, for example, small cap funds, into foreign funds, you definitely get active management becoming better than most. In fact, nearly 85% of active funds in the intermediate core bond market category outperform their passive peers through June of 2021. 85%. And that's what most of the active versus passive debate participants fail to talk about. They always focus on large cap stocks, but large cap stocks aren't always right for everybody, they're also not the best long-term performance category. If you're talking longer term, you want mid and small cap, and that's where a lot of the active managers do much better. In fact, you know, when we invest for clients, a lot of our more aggressive strategies are in mid and smaller cap holdings. So that's something to consider as well. And so that's what you have to understand, is you have to look at the details. Don't use a narrative as gospel. Look at the actual numbers and dig a little deeper than kind of the headlines. I know that's difficult. There's a lot of headlines being thrown at you, but it's definitely important for you to do that. And another example of that is cheaper funds succeed twice as often as the pricier ones. They have a 35% success rate outperforming versus the more expensive ones, only 17%. So once again, going back to that, the lagging of performance of active has far more to do with higher fees than them being bad at what they do. Okay. And make sure you understand that distinction. Now, when people take the time to leave an InvestTalk podcast review on iTunes, we'd like to thank them for the courtesy by getting to their question quickly. So here are some questions from an iTunes reviewer. Jeff from Alabama asks about Bristol Myers. And it says, I recently bought 100 shares of the company at around 58 when selling weekly cover calls at 59 strike. Let's see, Bristol Myers, BMY. You know, this is not the best in my mind to be selling cover calls because it's down a downtrend. And also the implied volatility is not very high, so you're not getting great premiums. So this is not a name that I would probably be investing in or doing cover calls in. Thanks for the review. Now we're heading into a break, and we're ready for your finance and investment questions now at InvestTalk at 888-99-CHART.
No two portfolios are alike, and every investor has a unique set of circumstances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, my name is Preet. I'm calling from Washington. I had a question about ticker symbol BICI, Biggie Properties. I bought the stock about 3 months ago, around the same time as the CEO. There was some insider trading. He bought some stock as well. I like the yield on it, and I also like the fact that it's an experience-based industry. Casino stocks are down right now, so I'm hoping it'd be a good time to buy this stock, but definitely not looking for a value trap. So if you could please help me out, I'd really appreciate that. And thank you guys for the great show.
Are you looking at Vici Properties? This is a real estate investment trust, and it owns, acquires, and develops real estate across gaming, hospitality, entertainment, and leisure. And it's company operates segments are real property business and golf course businesses. So it does have some golf exposure. Yeah, a lot of golf exposure, it looks like. So that's I think the issue here is golf. It actually has some secular headwinds. There's less younger people growing up and golfing. And so that's a struggle there in my mind. Now, it does yield about 5%, which is nice. Technically, it's had a pullback, but a lot of that has to do with interest rates rising. Remember, when interest rates rise, that is a headwind for the REIT sector often because they are many times bond proxies. Now, the issue I mainly have with this is that even before the pandemic, their business was struggling. And 2018 made $1.43 in funds from operation. 2019, $1.47. Now 2020 was a good year, but golf was in fashion because it was outdoors and it was socially distanced, and things were there were some tailwinds there. 2021 may supposed to make $1.82, but that estimate is now coming down for the full year. 2022, $1.95 expected. So it is now growing, but growth has started to slow. You look last quarter, revenue growth is up only 11%, whereas the quarter before is up 46%. Earnings were only up 5%, where the quarter before is up 28%. And that's what you're seeing here is this the deceleration, that 20% earnings growth, 50% revenue growth that you saw throughout the pandemic, that's not there anymore. Once again, that it was a very COVID-friendly time for golf courses, or COVID was a friendly time for golf courses. That's starting to shift now that people can travel a bit more, get outdoors in other ways. And I don't love this. I just don't, it's not bad. But I would be looking for an exit, a different area of the REIT space. It's just not my favorite. It's not bad, but I just don't like those secular headwinds. Now, let's touch a bit on onshoring. This is a big, big trend that I think is not going to reverse. And some companies are moving workers and production facilities closer to home. And others are actually buying out their suppliers or bringing in former contract workers in-house because it's hard to find people. So you might as well pay those contract workers directly, keep them on, secure them as employees, where if they're contract work, they could go work somewhere else very easily. And this is the new trend. And I think it's going to be more than just a short-term thing. And for more than a generation, executives at big companies have outsourced manufacturing to distant areas, distant countries. They outsourced many of those low-skill jobs to other countries, and they relied on just-in-time inventory. That's why our supply chains are really messed up, is because now, and they're still kind of trying to operate in a lot of ways in that sense, but it's harder to get goods. So you have to have higher levels of inventory. It's harder to get goods quickly. And so that's also dragging down our supply chains and grinding down ocean transportation to a halt. I'm still looking out here in Laguna Beach. I still see tankers or ships waiting to be unloaded from the port of Long Beach. And many companies have had trouble getting raw materials, hiring workers, booking space on these vessels. And if you look at the companies that are consulting with these customers in areas like automotive, medical, consumer durables, and they're shifting their manufacturing either back here to the U.S. or to Asia, actually Eastern Europe is a very popular place because, especially for those that have big business in Europe, it cuts the shipping times down to Europe dramatically, and the wage levels are still competitive. And in some ways, they're actually more stable regions these days than parts of Asia. And these companies are realizing that right now they're losing business, and they're stuck with efficient but very inflexible supply chains. So with efficiency and just-in-time inventory brings lack of flexibility. They're not very resilient. And now these companies are trying to figure out, how do we bridge that gap between efficient but also resilient? And the pendulum swung way too far, and the COVID crisis obviously has shifted that sentiment dramatically back. And so you add the retirement situation and how many people have retired and less workers, and they're also investing in automation. In fact, Pulte Homes is one example. They're now opening an automated manufacturing facility in South Carolina that is going to help with their shortage of skilled workers. And this is a trend that I do not think is reversing. This is going to be over the next decade plus. Now we're heading into a break, so give me a call at 888-99-CHART.
Of all the finance and investing podcasts and all the downloads in all the world, you've discovered InvestTalk.
At this time, do you think it would be better to keep it in this bond or move it to cash?
Looks like the sector is down today, so just thinking about, you know, potentially buying the dip.
And since InvestTalk hosts Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are committed to answering your questions with their unique blend of expert insight and unbiased guidance, you've got to ask yourself one question. Why haven't you called InvestTalk?
Hey, it's James from Australia. I'm loving the podcast.
You know you listen. You know you should call. You know you want to call.
So I was wondering the best options for long-term growth.
You'll get a reliable answer and the same positive feeling that tens of thousands of InvestTalk callers have already experienced.
Thank you so much. I love the show.
Don't forget to call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART. Each day, InvestTalk listeners submit their finance and investment questions via phone or email. Would you like your question to be put near the top of the list? Just take a minute or two to leave a review and rating for InvestTalk at iTunes. And be sure to include a brief question with your iTunes review comments.
Hi, my name is Ron. I'm in Northport, Florida, and I bought Alco and Rio about 6 months ago, and I've seen the Rio stock really go down significantly. I'm still holding on to it now, hoping and trying to figure out if it is going to recover. So any advice towards that particular stock would be appreciated. Have a good day.
All right, this is Rio Tinto, and it has come down pretty dramatically, about 29% from its 52-week high. And this all has to do with Chinese real estate and the fact that the majority of their revenues come from iron ore, which goes into producing steel in China. And China, you typically use that steel to build buildings, and with evergreen problem and the shift in policy away from economic growth fueled by the real estate sector, that is the major issue here. Now, the good thing about Rio is they do have a lot of other assets, from copper, aluminum, diamonds, gold, some industrial metals. And so they're a bit more diversified than your just your pure play iron ore miner, more of a pure play. And the biggest issue too is that they are out of, that they're coming from Australia, where a lot of their iron ore is purchased. And there's some clapbacks from China on the Australian government, and that's another issue as well. So overall, I don't like the downtrend. I don't think the risk versus reward is there quite yet. Earnings are expected to fall 34% next year from an increase of 75% this year. So my price of where I'd be interested in it is around $55 a share. Now it's at 63. So still waiting for that downtrend to abate. In fact, today just hit a new 52-week low. Or maybe not 52-week low, but about 52 weeks. So I'm passing on Rio for now. But around 55, that's where support kind of comes in, and that would be interesting around that level. Now, this is Invest Talk, and let's tackle another iTunes review question. P. Lorenz, O2, says, I would appreciate if you could review SNDR. SNDR, which is Schneider National. It has me scratching my head is what he meant. Earnings are higher than expected, and it's not doing that well. Well, let's see. Operates as a transportation and logistics service company in North America. Yeah, so that's really the issue here is, while earnings are going up, historically, they have not been a great allocator of capital. And I do think that shipping costs are kind of peaking, and typically when it's all in the news, it typically is the trade's kind of behind you. And I'm looking at some of the large shippers, and I'm seeing a lot of them roll over, show some relative weakness. What's interesting is trailing 12 months, they have negative free cash flow. And their operating cash flow actually has declined from 2020. So they're not operated. They're clearly not in the – they're not benefiting from the current shipping situation. And I don't see that changing, to be honest with you. And I don't really love the chart. It's just kind of been vacillating sideways. Let me take a look here at some longer-term data. I'm not a fan of it. I just don't love the chart. It's now up into resistance right around $26 a share. I would definitely pass on Schneider National. Look for a shipping company that has better long-term fundamentals and is benefiting from a tighter shipping supply market. And clearly this one is not really in that ballpark, because their cash flow is now negative. They should be printing cash in this environment. Now, here on Invest Talk, we get lots of stock-specific questions, and we get questions having to do with other financial aspects as well, like taxes and interest rates. So let's play one now.
Hey, Justin. Hey, Steve. This is Raul calling from Texas. I had a quick question about companies like PSEC, Prospect Capital, and Main Street Capital, and how they'll perform in the upcoming year with the rates that are going to be raised. Thank you.
All right, looking at Prospect Capital and Main Street Capital, and these are called BDC companies. And what they do is they're kind of like a closed-end investment company, and they invest in private companies, debt and equity, and they pay a high yield, 8.8% currently for PSEC. And in an inflationary environment, they actually should do relatively well. Where they get into trouble is a deflationary environment, where there's less dollars to go around to repay the loans that they have out. Okay, and that's the environment where they don't do that well. In an inflationary environment, they should do relatively well up until a point. Now, if their borrowing costs start to blow out,
for example. The bond market widens out, right? High yield. And that's kind of the way you think about it. It's kind of like a high yield bond. Kind of a junky rated high yield bond because that's what they are. They're very, very levered. But you're going to get that dividend, but a high level of volatility. And you need to be prepared for that high level of volatility. If you look at let's go back to the weekly chart on PSEC. This is Prospect Capital, PSEC is what he was speaking about. I wasn't sure about the other one. But in COVID, it went from $6.50 all the way down to a low of $3 and what was that, 75 cents or so. So you could see the extreme level of volatility, more than the overall market. But it's rebounded dramatically now to $8.20, even collecting a dividend since then. So I know it's probably nice. You're probably looking at the nice – is this a monthly dividend? Let me take a look here. Yeah, the monthly dividend that you're going after. But you just have to be prepared for that level of volatility. If you have some sort of economic disruption, you have yield spreads widen out, meaning yield spreads on junk bonds widen out, they're going to get hit because their cost of borrowing, cost of capital is going to go up. And so those are factors that could knock this back on its heels. Now, longer term, its return on equity, it's been pretty poor. Now, it's been good over the past year or so, but it's been in the high single digits, low teens. For a company who has decent leverage, I don't love that. So those are kind of the pros and the cons. It should do well, though, in an inflationary environment. Now, I think it's worth time to take a minute making you aware of the benefits of working with Steve and I that we offer at KPP Financial, which is based in Irvine, California. And it's where we practice parallel investing and operate with our philosophy, which is independent thinking and shared success. And parallel investing is how we accomplish that. And we invest right alongside our clients. So if you want to take advantage of our free portfolio review assessment via telephone or GoToMeeting, just go to investtalk.com or call our KPP Financial offices in Irvine, California at 800-557-5461. We'd love to help you in any way. No obligation, just a conversation. Help you understand your situation a bit better, pros and cons, and make sure that you are headed in the right direction with your financial path, your path to financial freedom. Now, we'd love to get live calls and any of your recorded questions too. So let's dip into the InvestTalk Voice Bank for a question that came in earlier from Atlanta.
Hello, this is Zach from Atlanta, Georgia. I got an IRA question. So I'm 20 years old, and I have around $20,000. And I've maxed out my Roth IRA last year, and I'm also financially still supported through my scholarship and through my parents. So this is not money that I need anytime soon. So I'm curious if I should even be putting money into my Roth IRA or if I should just put it into a regular IRA. Because if I put it into a Roth IRA, I'm realizing now that I'm not going to be able to touch it until I'm like 67 or something like that, which I wouldn't be able to pull out and use for a house. So I might be answering my own question right now, but I was just curious on if you think I should just be putting it into a regular traditional IRA or Roth IRA. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Good question. And the answer is no. I think you should continue to invest in that Roth IRA. You're young. You're probably in a low tax bracket. You probably don't earn a whole lot, like you said. It sounds like you're still in school. And I would be contributing to that Roth IRA because you're locking in that low tax rate. And your assumption that you can't touch it till you're older is actually wrong. You can take out what you have put into it at any time penalty-free because you've already paid taxes on it. Now, you can't touch the growth of it until you're 59 and a half. But the money that you put in, you can take out penalty free. So with a traditional IRA, you also can't touch that till you're 59 and a half. And if you take any money out before, it becomes a 10% penalty. So I absolutely would continue to feed money into that IRA, or sorry, that Roth IRA. And that will give you some flexibility if you did want to go out there and buy a house and have some flexibility on that front. Great call. Great question. Now let's touch a bit on the shift in monetary policy around the world. Now, inflation is not just a U.S. problem. It is global. And it's been more stubborn, I think, than most policymakers, central bank policymakers, have wanted to admit. And there's starting to be a shift in the bond market that is adjusting for a quickly tightening of monetary policy from around the world. First, Bank of England could be the first major central bank to increase their interest rates. Remember, the Fed is just talking about tapering QE. The Bank of England on Thursday is possibly going to be the first ones to major central banks to act in the face of higher goods and energy prices. And so the UK inflation rate in September was 3.1%, but it's expected to rise to 5% over the next couple of months, more than twice the bank's target. And investors are now putting a 62% chance that on Thursday, they will increase their target rate. Bank of Canada surprised markets last week, and they actually moved up the time frame for when they might first raise interest rates from zero. The Bank of Australia, they also had a policy meeting on last Tuesday and declined they shifted their target of when they are going to increase interest rates because of rising inflation. And lastly, most importantly, the European Central Bank. They pushed back on market expectations that the ECB will increase interest rates next year, but investors were not buying the message. They thought it was too weak. And they actually increased their bets that the ECB will raise interest rates next year. And that's the problem here, is these increasing levels of inflation around the world are putting pressure. And so they're trying to thread the needle. And the Fed, over the next couple of days, are going to have to have the proper messaging. And it's going to be a challenge to balance their credibility with flexibility, but then also give honest answers to the markets. And with inflation now at 3.6% for core inflation, that's excluding food and energy. If you add those in, you're talking closer to 5%. And policymakers are now less convinced than they were before of that inflation will moderate. Now, the U.S. bond market has increased their expectations for interest rate increases by the Fed next year. The probability of at least 2 quarter-point raises by the end of 2020 is now nearly 80%. 80. That's up from 20% after the Fed meeting in September. So you're talking about a 6-week turnaround, dramatic turnaround. And short-dated bond yields have been rising as well, and longer days have been relatively falling. That's the opposite of what occurred in 2013 during the taper tantrum. That's when longer dated U.S. bonds rates went up as opposed to down. Now they're just kind of they're going down a bit. Not a lot, but a little bit. And this is an interesting dynamic. The first time that we've seen them really get hawkish. And we had a tough September, but a strong October. And I'm wondering, will November confirm it? Will November confirm the reversal in markets that you're going into a tighter fiscal or monetary situation? Looser fiscal, but tighter monetary. And you're starting to see more and more indication that that is the case. Now, this is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein, and we have one goal here, is to help you achieve your own version of financial freedom. And our work continues after this final break. So if you're going to call, you want to do it right now. I want to know what is on your mind. We have about 7 more minutes before we close up shop, and that's why I want to hear from you. We love our live calls. We love our recorded calls. Whatever is on your mind, get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
And the question is, during the market downturn, do dividends stay fairly steady, at least for a blue chip companies as compared to share prices, or should I expect some fluctuation in the dividend stream that I'm hoping to get?
Got a question for Steve or Justin? Now is a good time to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART. Markets react to uncertainty. Are you prepared? Is your portfolio balanced? Is it optimized? Your financial future depends on the answers to those questions. Justin Klein is here now and ready to talk with you. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Duncan from New York. This question is kind of not about stocks, but about banks. I just recently bought a condo in Mexico, and it is a vacation rental. My bank is currently Capital One. They are great domestically, but in terms of bank wires, putting in information, trying to transfer money, it has been a nightmare. Would you suggest or know any banks that's good with foreign transactions? I know this is kind of might be out of your scope. Just want to give this a shot. I really do appreciate it and just trying to be a better investor overseas now. Thank you very much. Bye.
Definitely a bit out of my bailiwick, but I do think that Capital One is probably not where you'd want to be. They're more of a credit card issuer, and sure, they have some banking capabilities, but they're not going to be as widespread with their international capabilities. If you're looking at ones that are better for foreign transfers, for example, or foreign that have a broader foreign exposure, let's say that. Obviously, HSBC, Citibank might be a good one. JP Morgan, obviously very large and international. Those would be the ones that I would rather go with than a Capital One. Once again, Capital One's mainly focused on credit cards, and sure, they're expanding into banking, but that's not their tried and true business, and they're not going to really focus on international dealing with international customers in that way. And so I would be looking for the more bigger multinational banks, like I said, JP Morgan, HSBC, Citigroup, etc. Now let's pivot to an iTunes question. This is from Bob from Virginia. My question is, from a fundamental standpoint, what are the five main data points you utilize when determining the value of a stock? Now, this is a very loaded question because it depends on what method you're going by. Now, are you talking about the discounted cash flow method? Well, then you're looking at some sort of cash flow, whether that's earnings, could be operating cash flow, could be free cash flow. And then you're putting some sort of a growth rate on it, depending on how fast you expect the market to grow, the economy to grow, that company to grow, et cetera. Then you're discounting those future cash flows based on a discount rate, typically the 10-year treasury rate. So that's a discounted cash flow model. You also could just be looking from a multiple perspective and saying different companies within this industry on average are trading at this multiple of enterprise value to EBITDA, or just maybe a straightforward P/E ratio, which wouldn't be my recommendation, but yeah, enterprise value to EBITDA, enterprise value to cash flow, enterprise value to sales, those things I would be considering and comparing them to its peers. And that's another way to value a business, maybe giving it a premium to its peers because of better management, better product, better growth, or maybe a discount to its peers because it's maybe has thinner margins or something like that. So there are a lot of factors to consider when putting a value on a stock. Now, I think what's most important is not necessarily putting a value, because that's nobody's going to get the perfect answer to that. It's more about the business. Is the business good or bad? Has the business consistently produced strong profitability, from margins to return on equity, return on invested capital? Or is it cyclical? Does it go up and down? That's a big question. Now, I think we can squeeze in another brief question here. Let's try.
Hey, Steve and Justin. My name's Pete from Staten Island, New York. I had a question regarding U-Haul, U-H-A-L, kind of like the self-storage space, and I think they also have some ties to the insurance industry as well. Just wanted to get your guys' take on it. Thanks.
All right, U-Haul. I actually like U-Haul. It's a bit expensive at these prices, but I think with a lot of people moving to all over the country to cheaper areas, I'm actually a fan of this name and this space. And once again, it's a bit overbought, a bit expensive, but it is on my watch list. I'm Justin Klein. This completes another Invest Talk program. Steve Peasley and I thank you for listening. We encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads. Now over 35 million. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein Pavlis Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president and Justin Klein, chief executive officer of Klein Pavlis Peasley Financial. And they thank you for listening and welcome your comments or questions on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.